This is a special edition of Peace Talks Radio, the series and podcast on peacemaking and nonviolent conflict resolution. Today we spotlight three musicians known for merging their political and social conscience with their music and for working on and off the stage for change. I'm Paul Ingalls. Later we feature two who have sadly passed away, Harry Chapin and Marvin Gaye. But first we talk with someone who's still challenging us to think about our place in the world through his music and activism, singer-songwriter Jackson Brown.
You might ask what it takes to remember when you know that you've seen it before, where a government lies to a people and a country is drifting to war.
Lives in the Balance from 1986 may have been Jackson Brown's most high-profile political song, taking aim at the U.S. covert war in Nicaragua, months before the Iran-Contra scandal broke to the public. But people forget that his very first hit from 15 years earlier, Doctor My Eyes, though upbeat in tone, was really about witnessing life's hardships and anxiously telling the doctor his fear that he'd learned not to cry. And 50 years after Doctor My Eyes, on a 2021 album release called Downhill from Everywhere, Jackson Brown is still asking questions he wants us to ask ourselves.
Do you think of the ocean as yours? Do you think about it at all?
I was involved with the civil rights movement from a very early age, and so everybody around me was.
Early age when?
Like when I was 14, I belonged to CORE, the Congress of Racial Equality, and a meeting, say, for that would devolve into simply a party, a dance, you know. And I was in L.A., and I was, like, the first time I heard, you know, gonna get right down to the real nitty-gritty, it was at a record party after what had been a sort of strategy meeting about a demonstration or, you know.
Is there any way to explain in maybe your household, your upbringing, your parents, or is it something just innate, do you think, that drove your consciousness?
Well, I was raised in the household. We were more or less colorblind, and I say more or less because at a certain point, my parents had to tell me what prejudice is and how that I would encounter it. Here's one way it played out, you know, like... we were having a discussion about civil rights in a classroom when I was probably about 14 or 15. And I was espousing my, you know, belief in racial equality. And this other kid, my contemporary, said, oh, that's all good and fine, but come on, like, admit it. You would feel differently if it was your sister and whether your sister was going with a black guy. And I was going, I said, well, as a matter of fact, my sister does date a black guy. And he not only did not believe me, but he just thought it was the lowest of low, you know, strategies to say that. Like, did I have no pride or something, that kind of thing. I just felt so bad for him. I thought, well, you know, so you don't believe me, but my sister was dating this great musician named Joe Gilbert. And he was a musician we all were crazy about. And I thought, what is the big deal? The problem is that you don't know any black people. You've never hung with any black people. You haven't met them, and you haven't met them on common ground, and you haven't experienced anything. To them, they're permanently over there, separate from you. And I saw that that's the problem, is that people don't have those experiences that illustrate to them their common humanity.
I'm wondering if the activism spark might have been lit a little bit by just seeing John Lennon and Yoko Ono in the late 60s, or George Harrison's concert for Bangladesh.
Certainly, yeah.
And Dylan.
Well, Bob Dylan was majorly involved in the civil rights movement and wrote songs on the subject, you know, like Only a Pawn in Their Game or The Lonesome Death of Hattie Carroll. I mean, there he was very involved and wrote songs in the subjects that accompanied the civil rights era. I'll call it the civil rights era because that movement continued, and the movement has had to continue. But also Buffy St. Marie wrote songs, Universal Soldier, and also, you know, a lot of songs about Native American rights. And she's a fantastic writer. And in the case of all this music, the songs about love and relationships accompanied the themes that we're all encountering on in social themes.
It's very easy for me to see your writing, your recording, your touring, your activism, charitable work through a peacemaking mission lens. And I'm just wondering if that resonates with you as a way of seeing it, feeling it as you're doing it.
I see that there are so many people that are much more committed in terms of their time, their constant time, than I am. If I'm able to put something in words into a song or figure out a way of talking about something that might might succeed, then I do. But it's really up to me. I don't think I have that much at stake. I think I've got the best job you can imagine. My job is to talk about life. My job is to relate what I encounter, and that my willingness to talk about social issues, just to give it a handle, alternately it's described by some as like the reason I'm not more popular, or like, well, no, you can't. Oh, that's really why he doesn't have a larger audience, is because he's, you know, talking about political stuff. I don't look at it that way at all. Even those people who maybe have been worried by my embracing political ideas and my songs in the beginning now see them as a necessary part of life, and it's just not the whole picture at all. It's a part of it. It's an essential part of it. But for an activist, they have responsibility to the people and to the issue and to the people that aligned with them on a cause that far outstrips mine. I think if I can help, I will. You know, I try. And it goes from human rights issues to the environment, which, of course, the environment is a human rights issue now. And you see that it is really also environmental justice, you know. There's a reason, all these, now we have phrases like frontline communities or fence line communities, the people who have to live adjacent to an oil well or something. You know, these, you realize that the people who profit from these industries don't live in the neighborhoods that are impacted. But they certainly do live in a planet that will be ultimately impacted. And their children will live in a planet that is affected by their activities. And so I think that the question about what do you think peace would look like is a good starting point. It's not just an absence of war. It's also the presence of justice. You know, if we're barricaded in our privilege, we might miss the fact that privilege is part of an injustice and part of an unequal distribution of the wealth, part of an unequal application of justice. You know, we're countries in a really pivotal place. You can't pass laws or pass legislation that dictates people's awareness or willingness to be empathetic, you know. I mean, we have deep problems in this country. There's a divide here. I want to see you holding out your light. I want to see you light the way. But whether everything will be all right, it's just a little soon to say.
A bit of A Little Soon to Say, again from Jackson Browne's Downhill from Everywhere 2021 release. Hear more from Jackson Browne in our hour-long version of this show, or in my complete nearly hour-long visit with him at our website, peacetalksradio.com. That's peacetalksradio.com. Look for our June 2021 episode. And now we spotlight this moment in 1971, when Marvin Gaye redefined what a Motown hit could be, with first his one-of-a-kind single, What's Going On?, followed by the landmark album of the same name. Picket lines and picket signs. Don't punish me with brutality. Talk to me so you can see. Oh, what's going on? What's going on? Yeah, what's going on? Well, you know where to find the whole song in an instant, of course. What we can bring you only here are two music scholars to give us the context and background on Marvin's groundbreaking release. In a moment, University of South Carolina Associate Professor of Ethnomusicology and African American Studies, Brigitta Johnson, and first, Hannah Grantham, Chief Curator at Detroit's Motown Museum.
Marvin's life growing up was a very unstable time in this nation, in this world. But in particular, I think he struggled as a Black man to figure out, how do I behave? How do I act like a responsible adult in this crumbling society that I'm seeing? During his late teens to adulthood, to the time in his early 30s when he produced What's Going On, he had witnessed countless attacks, countless riots, you know, year after year of unrest and turmoil, protests, outright violence through wars, imperialism. He's seeing all of this compound.
definitely, when we look back in the 60s, right before what's going on is happening, there is a context of just another explosion of a genre we now call soul. Soul music is popping out, and soul is, you know, a more core aesthetic Black sound. People are digging deeper into the blues sound, deeper into the gospel sounds, and bringing them into like secular type of realms for, you know, another kind of rhythm and blues that's now more ethnically conscious of the Black experience. And so when we think about Sam Cooke coming out of A Change's Gonna Come, and he also is being influenced by what's happening in the folk realm, where you have Bob Dylan's Blowing in the Wind is touching people. When you think about Bob Dylan putting out Blowing in the Wind and Sam Cooke singing, I want to write something like that, it's speaking to our times. You have James Brown here, Say It Loud, I'm Black and I'm Proud. All these Black artists specifically identifying outwardly as Black artists. You have the Black awareness movement, people wearing afros, and this idea of, as opposed to trying to assimilate into mainstream society and going into blending in, you have more people saying, well, we shouldn't be blending in. We should be ourselves. Black is beautiful. So you have all these things happening. And so you think about how the Vietnam War starts to impact the Black community, specifically because of the draft. You have so many African-American men from communities been taken into this war, and many not coming back, or many coming back with drug problems, or many coming back with mental problems. And then you see people like Marvin Gaye also looking at this and saying, what is this going to sound like? Who's going to be our voice in these types of, you know, these types of songs and conversations? And so you see him definitely taking that that same wave of a type of protest where it speaks to these issues, speaks to, in some cases, the spirituality of the Black community, as you see on the almost very end of What's Going On, where you're questioning things, even what you've been taught as far as religion and spirituality, and where is God in all this? You start seeing him doing that stuff where most often not people wouldn't do that in public. And so you see him exploring these aspects of the Black experience, even through this kind of underlying look at the world. Because of course, What's Going On covers ecology, it covers war, it covers how man treats man. But at the same time, the core question is how America is teaching Black people, you know? And so it has this universal appeal, but at the same time, very specific, can be drawn to a Black experience where you get to the 1960s, 100 years removed from the Emancipation Proclamation, and people still are trying to fight for humanity.
When he comes into 1971, when the album was released, within the last decade, you had lost civil rights leaders like Malcolm X, like Martin Luther King Jr., like Fred Hamilton, who was a leader of the Black Panther Party in Chicago. You saw presidential candidates assassinated on the campaign trail. And those are just, you know, the noteworthy names. Those don't account for all the smaller people that he encountered in his day-to-day life who were no longer with him, which also included his singing partners like Tammy Terrell, who had died in 1970. So I think a lot of that kind of despair was on his mind as he comes into this, but also he's a human. He's still trying to make his way out of what it seems like no way. And I think he found that through this album.
That's Motown Museum curator Hannah Grantham. And again here, University of South Carolina professor Brigitta Johnson.
Creatively speaking, as we see in the 60s, some of the top artists are now thinking about, you know, do I need to stay with Motown? I want to have more control over my music. I want to write the songs. I'm a songwriter. I want to write the songs that I want to write, how I want to write them. I want to produce my songs. And so you have a type of creative power struggle already happening around Motown, but definitely with top artists like Marvin Gaye. And of course, you know, you're at Motown and they're about hits and pop tunes and dance tunes and not really getting into message music as much and really not dealing with outwardly protest type music.
Hannah Grantham, can you relate the story of Obie from the Four Tops collaborating with Marvin musically on What's Going On?
Yeah, so actually Obie Benson was the one that came up with the first lyrics to What's Going On. He had witnessed what's called Bloody Thursday, which was in Berkeley, California. So he saw anti-Vietnam protesters attacked by a police unit in Berkeley, California while he was on tour with the Four Tops. And he, you know, jotted down some words that struck him in the moment, decided that the song was not the right fit for the Four Tops, but he came back to Detroit. Marvin was in this stage where he was trying to look for something next, the next message that he could produce. He definitely wanted his music to have this significance that he felt was more relevant to the community. And so he took Obie's words and figured out a way to put it within his own style and his own perspective, and worked with Obie Benson among a few other Motown staff and creative members and created that song.
taking some of these conversations and looking at the world and asking these broader questions, but not just doing that lyrically, but also how to do that sonically. You hear this kind of wonderful saxophone solo. You have congas in the background. You have this, you know, vocal background, this singing ahs and oohs in the background. And you have, you know, almost a doubling of his lead vocals, this echo effect. And it kind of sets you up for the whole album. And even the groove that's set down and what's going on continues on in various variations for like the first six tracks, right? So it's all it sets you up for the master groove of the album. There's so much going on here, but it doesn't sound cluttered. It sounds very calm, very almost like air. And you have these strings flying on the top, and you have, you know, wonderful bass line at the bottom. And it just sets you up for the whole album.
Well, and I love that image. And I also think about real powerful technique in so-called protest music. And Dylan used it over and over and over again, is even Blowing the Wind. It's like, it's all questions, right? How many times must a man walk down? Is to put it in the form of a question.
And I think about the second track, it's even more personal. What's happening, brother? You know, and so it's more of the same concept of bringing the conversation deeper and deeper as you get into the album. You may move away from some of the questions and get into now reflections.
Can't find no work, can't find no job, my friend. Money is tied up and it's ever been. Say, man, I just don't understand what's going on across this land. Oh, what's happening, brother? Yeah.
And the other thing that I'm thinking about is that even to this day, even to the George Floyd trial, there was all this business about trying to label, identify anger, right? When I think about Inner City Blues, is that you go through this whole orchestrated litany of the state of the world. And then at the end, there's this very elegant, but honest, somewhat restrained expression of the emotion that it should all be leading up to.
Oh, make me wanna holler, throw up both my hands. Yeah.
Makes me want to holler, throw up both my hands, you know. But what's going to happen to me if I do holler?
It makes me want to, the way they do in my life. And it's those two things happening in that one quick line, that you feel a particular way, you feel a particular anger, a frustration, and an outrage. But you're also acknowledging how it's being surveilled, that is being, it's being surveilled, it's being watched, it's being policed. And so the way they do my life, and so we are raised to thinking you're your own person, you have your own life, you control your destiny. But when you say the way they do my life, you're acknowledging that in this particular social construct, someone else has control to the point where you can't really express your anger in a particular way because the way they do my life, the way it could be perceived or thought about, or if someone's going to have a reaction to it, or it can actually end your life. And so this idea that it resonates even till the day, it's because of that sentiment. We have people who are immediately asked to channel or to clamp down on their anger when they've been horribly abused. I think that's definitely a big part of how this song and this album becomes almost eternal, because we're still in the same situations. We're still facing the same kind of oppressions, and even the stifling of speaking out of those against those oppressions are still among us, unfortunately.
Music scholar from the University of South Carolina there, Brigitta Johnson. Earlier, Hannah Grantham, curator at the Motown Museum, Hittsville itself, in Detroit, Michigan. Hear more from my chats with them both, either in the hour-long version of this show or in my complete interviews with them at peacetalksradio.com. Go to peacetalksradio.com and find the June 2021 episode.
It was raining hard in Frisco. I needed one more fare to make my night. A lady up ahead waved to flag me down. She got in at the light.
Well, many of you know the rest of that story, and those of you who don't should look up Taxi by Harry Chapin where you get your music. I'm Paul Ingalls. Our Peace Talks radio special has heard from Jackson Browne already and about Marvin Gaye. And our third musician activist to discuss is Harry Chapin, known for 10 years of great story songs from 1972's Taxi, Cats in the Cradle, WOLD, I Want to Learn a Love Song, and many, many more, and many deeper album cuts, too, that explored loneliness, hard luck stories, poverty, protest, and society's divisions. And although Harry was famous for doing loads of benefit shows, he worked hard for good causes offstage all of his life, which was cut short. He was 38 years old when his car was crushed in a road accident on his way to another benefit concert, July 16, 1981. A 2020 documentary called Harry Chapin, When in Doubt, Do Something, tells his story. And I got together on a Zoom call the film's director, Rick Korn, also Harry's partner in hunger prevention, Bill Ayers. He and Harry founded Why Hunger, still a working nonprofit decades later today. And in a moment, we'll hear Jason Chapin, one of Harry's adopted kids.
We'll watch our sweet dreams fly far away.
So many of his songs are really about people who are not, you know, having the time of their life. These are people who are struggling on a daily basis. And so he's able to channel that because he had a lot of his own struggles, and he brings them to life and helps them understand through his songs that, you know, we all struggle, but we can get through these struggles, and that there's a lot to appreciate in life. You know, this is the most divided time in my lifetime, and our country is one country. And, you know, I think my father's message was always, let's find ways to bring people together. Yes. Let's find ways to understand what we have in common. And I think he would have been jumping up and down saying, we can't be fighting against ourselves. We can't be at war with ourselves. We have to be part of one community, a part of one country, and help realize our full potential. It just tells me that what we're going through now is not going to work. We can't end up with, you know, a divided country trying to achieve two different objectives. We have to realize that if we work together, we're helping each other, and we're helping to realize our ultimate destiny, which is, you know, fulfilling our potential.
Right. Who can tell us a little bit more about the earliest seeds for Harry's determined social justice efforts? Bill?
Well, I think part of it came from his family. They weren't rich. The other thing, of course, is that he recognized that there was tremendous injustice in the world. One of the people that I think was very, very influential on his whole development as a social activist was his brother, Jim. Now, unfortunately, you know, Jim died many years ago. But I have to tell you, Jim was a genius, absolute genius. He was his older brother, and he was very much involved in democratic socialism. And he had a big effect on Harry.
Bill, before I forget, when and how did you meet Harry Chapin for the first time?
I met Harry because his brother Tom was on my show. I was starting a show called On This Rock. It was a network radio show for the ABC Radio Network. It was all over the country. You know, I called up Harry and we got together. We did several shows together. And then I had some crazy ideas. One of them was to do something that I called a Hungerthon. He thought that was a great idea. And we've done those. And without the Hungerthons, Why Hunger would not have existed in the way that it did. We've just raised millions and millions of dollars. And Harry thought that was a great idea. And we did the first one in New York City on WNEW. And then we did them all over the country. We did in San Francisco a couple, and Philadelphia, and Detroit, all over the place. That's how we got started. And we've reached tens of millions of people with the Hungerthons and continue to do it.
Now, Bill Ayers, at some point, Harry goes all in on charity concert efforts, saying at some point in the film that out of maybe 250 concert dates that he'd play in a given year, 100 were for some charitable cause. This film really shows Harry's active commitment to making his music work for good causes in the mid-1970s, doesn't it, Bill Ayers?
Harry would do anything to get the job done.
Great. Hey, Jason and Rick, you have any thoughts about this sort of role that Harry Chapin seemed to play? It seems like he was a real bridge builder. Rick, did you want to continue?
Harry was really concerned, especially towards after Carter loses to Reagan, and he kind of sees the writing on the wall. And it seems to me that Harry, after Reagan won, it seemed like he kind of doubled up on everything to make up for the loss.
Sure, because remember, we had just finished with the Presidential Hunger Commission. And Harry was at every meeting. I think he was the only one who was at every meeting to work on hunger and poverty all over the world. After the elections, we sat and said to ourselves, this is awful. We could see the Presidential Hunger Commission's report was going to go nowhere, that Reagan wasn't going to be interested in it. So we started figuring out what could we do to make things happen in this new world of 1981.
The really amazing thing about Harry is his ability to bring conservative Republicans together with, you know, liberals and make it work. And you see that in the film. You see him with Bob Dole, you know. Those are rare things these days.
Yeah. Jason, I think you mentioned earlier, how old were you when your father died in the car accident?
17.
Okay. I know it's hard to be asked about it, but what do you recall about those days of dealing with that news and the loss at that time?
Well, obviously the immediate family, it was a devastating loss, but he was also very involved with the whole extended family. So that was really a big hole that was very hard to fill. But at the same time, what I look back at and appreciate so much is it wasn't as though everybody said, well, we're not going to do anything about this. I think everybody tried to figure out what role they could play in order to keep his legacy going and what things that they wanted to do individually that they thought were worthwhile. So, you know, to have Why Hunger not only continue to survive, but also grow and become a much more dynamic organization because of so many family members and friends and others getting behind it. And so the important lesson for me is that, again, you know, a lot of times it takes one person to get something started, but it takes a whole hell of a lot of other people to keep it going and to help it grow to, you know, levels that were unimaginable when it was first started. You know, another song that I'm very close to is What Made America Famous, which was really my father's commentary on what makes this country what it is. And it's when individuals care enough in order to do something that maybe goes against what everyone else is doing. It's just so important to them about their being.
I had the kind of a dream that maybe they're still trying to teach in school, of the America that made America famous, and of the people who just might understand that half together, yes, we can create a country better than the one we have made of this land. We have the choice to make each man who dares to dream reaching out his hand a prophet or just a crazy damn dreamer of a fool. Yes, a crazy fool. And something's burning somewhere. Does anybody care? Is anybody there? Is anybody there?
The song What Made America Famous by Harry Chapin. Thanks to Jason Chapin, Bill Ayers, and Rick Korn talking about their 2020 film, Harry Chapin, When in Doubt, Do Something. You can hear more from them, a full hour from all of them, at peacetalksradio.com. peacetalksradio.com. Just look for the June 2021 episode for that, plus more on Marvin Gaye and our longer conversation with Jackson Browne. peacetalksradio.com is where to go to hear all the shows in our series going back to 2002 and where to find out how to support our nonprofit work. I'm Paul Ingles. Thanks for listening to and for supporting Peace Talks Radio.